80 years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I am your host and the project creator of Chasing Earhart, Chris Williamson. Welcome to episode 14. Now, a little bit of housekeeping before we get into this week's guest. I wanted to first talk about our brand new YouTube channel. We just debuted it last week. We have the first two guests, Abigail Harrison, also known as Astronaut Abby, and Mark Hall Patton from Clark County, Nevada, and Pawn Stars, up on the YouTube channel right now. If you go to chasingearhart.com and you click on our news page, you'll see those videos on the news page. You can click and link right to YouTube. We're very excited about the YouTube channel. It's going to be a big player in our project in the coming weeks and months. And we're going to be putting spotlight clips up on every guest that's being featured on the project. So every time we shoot with somebody, we'll put a little minute to 2 minute clip of them on the YouTube page, so you can get a very quick taste of what they're going to be offering to the Chasing Earhart documentary, which is going to be releasing in the fall of 2019. We're very excited. We're going to have another video up on the site pretty soon with Cassie Pacall, and we're going to keep releasing probably 1 to 2 videos a week for the coming months that we can be promoting the project. So we're very excited about that. We really encourage you guys to go to YouTube, search Chasing Earhart. You'll see the Chris Evan Films YouTube page. You can subscribe there. We really appreciate any subscriptions and any feedback you can give on the footage. If you wanted to get a look at the Chasing Earhart documentary and the actual interview footage of the documentary, this is a perfect way to do it. It's sort of world premiering some of the footage that we're going to have, and we're very excited to bring that to you. So please head on over there, check it out, and give us some feedback. Let us know what you think of the project so far. We're very excited to hear back from everybody, and we're very excited to interact with everybody. Now, I briefly want to discuss one of the upcoming events that we have that we've been talking about in the past 13 episodes of the podcast, and that is our cross-collaboration episode with Astonishing Legends. We're very excited about that. The time is almost upon us. We're getting ready to do the recording for that pretty soon, and from my understanding, we'll be having that released hopefully by the end of November or sometime in December. We're very excited about that. We will be pushing that heavily on our social media and on our website. We're looking very much forward to working with Scott Philbrick and Forrest Burgess and their entire team over there at Astonishing Legends. We're going to put together something very special for you. They're doing a return to their Earhart episode retrospective series that they did back in 2014, and this time they're taking us along with them. So it's going to be a very exciting time for us, and we're very much looking forward to that. And we will be talking about that in the coming weeks and in the coming month of the project. Okay, on to this week. The guest that we have this week on Chasing Earhart on the podcast is one that I've been actually trying to get a hold of and speak with for quite some time. His name is Dick Spink. He was one of the principals in the recent Lost Evidence documentary that aired on the History Channel. This documentary was seen by almost 5 million people all over the world. And the documentary obviously had a little bit of controversy around it. We're going to get into that with him a little bit in this interview, but Dick is a fantastic guy, very knowledgeable. He has one of my favorite backstories that I've ever heard when it comes to Amelia Earhart and how he sort of came into this process and came into the research that he's done on Amelia Earhart. Makes for a really great interview. In this interview, we discuss kind of the beginnings of how Dick got pulled into this whole thing and how he's sort of brought a fresh perspective and a fresh approach to the Amelia Earhart disappearance investigation when it comes to the Japanese capture hypothesis. And we've talked a little bit about the photo that has been pretty much all over the world. It's been in the news media. It's been all over social media. We discuss a little bit about the photo and kind of the origins of the photo and what his personal feelings are on that photo. And we talk about what's next for the Japanese capture hypothesis and a possible second feature film when it comes to the Lost Evidence documentary. And we're very excited to talk with him about that. So this is a really great interview. I think it's going to do a lot of people good to hear Dick's perspective on the Japanese capture hypothesis, on the Lost Evidence documentary, and on the work that he's been doing for about 5 years now when it comes to Amelia Earhart. So, without further ado, it's been a long time coming. Dick Spink, you're up. Our guest today on the Chasing Earhart podcast is it's one I've been really wanting to talk to you for a long time. His name is Dick Spink. He was an integral part of the Lost Evidence documentary that just released on History not too long ago. He's been doing this for quite some time. He's got one of my most favorite backstories ever when it comes to Amelia Earhart.
Dick, it's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on the show, Chris. I appreciate it.
So I want to start with you the same way I start with every one of our interviews. If you've ever heard them, I always ask the first question. Can you tell everybody a little bit about your education, your professional background?
I was born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, lived most of my life here outside of living a couple of years in Alaska, and went to Washington State University, where I got degrees in engineering, agriculture, and education. And I currently am a teacher part-time at Mount Vernon High School. And then I also founded a business in 1989 called Dynatrax Incorporated. I currently sell aluminum boat kits all around the world, which I've got a webpage, aluminumboatkit.com, which explains kind of what it is I do. So that's what took me to the Marshall Islands in the first place.
And as I mentioned earlier, you have one of my personal favorite backstories when it comes to Amelia Earhart. Can you tell everyone about your earliest recollections of Amelia and how she came into your life professionally?
if you would have asked me that question 6 years ago, I'd say, well, Amelia Earhart, wasn't she the woman that just crashed and sank in the Pacific Ocean?
Right.
You know, it wasn't until I was in the Marshall Islands just, you know, 6 years ago, five and a half, 6 years ago, when I was selling my aluminum boat kits. And, you know, I was at Tony DeBroom's house, who was just died this last time when I was in the Marshall Islands this summer. Anyway, we were at Tony's house, and there were a lot of discussions going on. President Christopher Loke was there. Ramsey Reimers, who's my Marshallese brother. We call each other our brothers from a different mother. And he was talking about, Senator Tony was talking about just the different war relics that were on the lagoons, in the bottoms of the lagoons. And as we were talking about that, I just happened to make the comment, didn't Amelia Earhart disappear in this part of the world? And it was an old guy at the end of the table who said, yeah, you know, she landed on our island and my uncle watched her for 2 days. And I kind of shrugged that off and laughed a little bit. And Tony and Ramsey both looked at me and said, hey, Dick, this guy's serious. She was here. The conversation went on that evening. And so later I talked to Ramsey about it. And what happened from that point on is the next time I came back to the Marshall Islands, I brought a video recorder and I started recording these conversations from some of these old people like Charlie, Dominic, the Reverend Lajuan, whose father watched Amelia Earhart land in Mille Atoll. And I started putting together these conversations from some of these people. And it all evolved from there for me just over 5 years ago.
So, I mean, as a high school science teacher, you alluded to that a little bit earlier. You do bring a very interesting sort of approach into the search for Amelia Earhart and Mr. Noonan, of course. What's that been like for you to bring sort of a fresh perspective into a hypothesis, which we'll get into in a little bit, is quite old. It's been around since the 1960s. What's that like for you to bring that fresh approach there?
Well, you know, it was a real shock to me when I was in the Marshall Islands and started hearing these stories. So I started to do a little bit of research of my own. I picked up The Search for Amelia Earhart by Fred Gorner and started doing a little bit of research, started talking to these people in the Marshall Islands, realized that, you know, there's a lot to this that doesn't make sense from crash and sink point.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're really, truly, with all the research I've done and being recognized for what I've done right now, there really is two theories that really hold water over anything else. Everything else just doesn't make sense at all. There's the crash and sink theory, which is what the United States Navy has come out and said this is official. And there is the Japanese landing theory, right, because of all the different eyewitnesses that saw Amelia Earhart about from Mille Atoll to Jaluit, information we have of her being in Kwajalein, Tanapang Harbor in Saipan, and all the different people that saw her in Saipan, to the U.S. Marines that had firsthand evidence of her and her aircraft being in Saipan. And you just can't ignore all that. it's amazing what information there is on her from being in Japanese custody. Anything else, there's just no evidence.
Yeah. I mean, you have become one of the leading researchers in the Amelia Earhart disappearance case. When you first heard, you touched on it earlier, when you first heard of the Japanese capture hypothesis, and, you know, you had kind of were of the same mind of a lot of folks who, before they hear anything else, just kind of accept the U.S. government official story that she, you know, simply crashed and sank, and that's that. What was your first initial reaction to that? Were you just sort of on board until you kind of heard the Marshallese hypothesis and started speaking to some of these folks over there? Or how did that work? What was that transition like for you?
Well, you know, when you first hear, oh, the Japanese took Amelia Earhart, right? You know, that's pretty unbelievable at first to hear that comment. Oh, the Japanese captured her and that was it. Well, you know, that was a real tough one. The first time I ever heard that, I think, was probably when I saw the movie Amelia like 10 years ago. At the very end, they alluded to possible different things that had happened. And one of them was, oh, the Japanese captured her. You know, right. At first you kind of shrug that off and think, oh, you know, that could be. How would anybody be that cruel? Well, when you really go back and you study what happened in World War II, the rape of Nanking, and the way the Japanese were pushing their way through Asia and across the Pacific, you know, anything was possible with the way the Japanese were doing what they had to do to get where they needed to be. And it was a very, very brutal, brutal history. So once you start looking at that, you know, then you can realize that just about anything is possible with what the Japanese needed to do.
Yeah, let's get into it a little bit here. So, I mean, you touched on the eyewitness testimony. I mean, obviously, a cornerstone of the Japanese capture hypothesis is the over 200 eyewitnesses that, you know, throughout the Marshall Islands, as you alluded to earlier, and the military, of course, that were there. In your particular case, what is it about that chunk of information, all these eyewitnesses, you know, what does that do? Why is that so crucial? Because for so long, that seemed to be kind of the cornerstone and the backbone of the hypothesis before you came along and started finding physical artifacts and things like that. We'll, of course, get into that. What is it about the eyewitness testimony in particular that just really cements this case?
Well, when you're doing research, one of the most important things is to try and establish a timeline. And the timeline that went along with a lot of these people that started pulling information out from Fred Gorner to Thomas Devine, you know, the timeline made a lot of sense. The establishment of, you know, some of the photographs, our photograph that we'll talk about in a little bit,
sure.
And logs of the Koshima Maru that puts the ship at the right place at the right time. You just have to look and see some of these different things. Talk about the people that were involved. Testimonies from people like Biliman Amram, who was a member of parliament, who was a very, very, a credible man in the Marshall Islands. And you just have to ask yourself, why would somebody like this fabricate a story?
Yeah.
And, you know, we had President Hilda Heine say that because she knows Biliman quite well. I'm Christopher Loke, the last president of the Marshall Islands, who I was very good friends with. I still am good friends with him. And, you know, they all knew Biliman quite well. And Biliman had told them all the story. And they said, there's no way this guy made this story up. I just had a great interview with Joe DeBroom just in August, just a couple months ago, who completely reinforced and reiterated the same story again about Amelia Earhart. And so, you know, you just can't, you can't dismiss these people and that story. Not yeah, when you know it personally and intimately like I do.
So, okay. So for the folks out there that may not know and may not have got a chance to watch the recent documentary, can you briefly kind of synopsize what you believe happened? I'll just ask you straight out. What happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan?
Well, you know, as they were flying to Howland Island, as of course the Coast Guard cutter Itasca knows, I'm not going to get too specific on this because I know all your other podcasts have talked a little bit about it. And as they were flying to Howland Island, the Itasca, sitting at Howland Island was in clear blue sky. they were bellowing smoke out when they started to get worried to make a smoke screen, and the smoke was settling around the ship. It was beautiful. Right. The only bad weather historically in that point was to the northwest of Howland Island. Okay, so one of her fallback plans was to turn around and fly back to the Gilbert Phoenix groups to find land. She did report in under 1,000-foot cloud cover. And the first place the Itasca looked for her when they pulled up, and she was late, they pulled anchor and they went to the northwest. The United States Navy asked and said, you know, through the consulate, the Japanese consulate, you know, we believe Amelia Earhart is down in the Marshall Islands. All this is official record. We believe Amelia Earhart is down in the Marshall Islands. We need to go look at her. And they said, absolutely not. No way will any U.S. warships be allowed in our territorial waters. We'll consider it an act of war. But what we'll do is we'll send three ships to go look for her. One ship was all that actually went out, and that was the Koshu Maru. Okay, so here she is. She lands at Mille Atoll when she turns around and flies backward. Now, the biggest thing that a lot of people have a problem with is saying, she didn't have enough fuel to do that. Okay, well, I'm holding in my hands right here. This is a 36-page fuel study that was done by C.L. Johnson right on the front. Now, Clarence Kelly Johnson, for those of you that don't know who Clarence Kelly Johnson was, Clarence Kelly Johnson was the founding engineer of Skunk Works. he designed the SR-71, the U-2, the F-104, the P-38, the Kingfisher, just to name a few, okay? Well, he was an engineer working at Lockheed, and he did this 36-page fuel study for Amelia Earhart. And he knew exactly, I mean, he was one of the engineers that designed that airplane. This is the greatest aeronautical mind of the 20th century. So all these other people that put fuel studies together say, oh, this is what she did and this is what she did, making all this speculation. No, this right here is the official fuel study of Amelia Earhart. Anything else beyond this doesn't have the credibility that this has.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you go to page 9 under summary of this fuel study, and I'll read it for you exactly what it says.
Okay.
As a result of the study just concluded, the following results are obtained. Number one, it's possible to fly this Lockheed Electra Model 10E nonstop for a distance between 4,100 and 4,500 miles, starting out with 1,200 gallons of gasoline and the proper amount of oil. We know that she had over 1,100 gallons in her tanks when she left. One tank, if it would have been completely full, which was the tank that had the 100-octane fuel in it for her takeoff and lay, it was short of a full tank, so that would have put her a little bit over 1,100 gallons. There is no means, no recollection of anything of Fred Noonan ever saying, oh, we only had 900 gallons or 950 gallons when we took off. That's not recorded anywhere.
Right.
Okay. This is official, and that's what we know she had leaving Ley, New Guinea, which is going to put her, even if, and a good friend of mine, Pat Donovan, who owns a Lockheed L-12, who's flown to Honolulu twice in New Zealand and back, and just flew to Europe this last year with his Lockheed 12. At first, he said, oh, Amelia didn't have the range in her airplane with the fuel. And I let him look at this study, and after he did it, he said, you know, even if she only made it 80% the distance of this, she still could have made it. So she had plenty of fuel to make it back to Millie. Millie's only 800 miles back, and we don't know how close she ever made it to Howland Island. She made it to the northwest, and you know, she had a habit of drifting to the north. You know, she missed Dakar on that same flight across the Atlantic by 150 miles to the north, spent the night in a pasture with Fred trying to get their bearings so they could get up and make the next flight the next morning. So as far as the fuel study goes, there you have it.
Yeah, no, that's quite impressive. And I think we're going to try to get a link to that on the website so people can actually look at that and actually read that through that themselves. So as we touched on here, this isn't a new hypothesis by any stretch of the imagination. The pioneer of this hypothesis, or one of the names that really kind of, when you touched on it earlier, seems to kind of come to the surface when talking about this, is Fred Gerner, who obviously wrote The Search for Amelia Earhart. I'm sure I know you've read it. Can you talk a little bit about, I guess a little bit about Fred and what he did to sort of shine the spotlight on this hypothesis? Because, I mean, he kind of looked at this and thought, wait a minute, something's not right here. And he kind of started investigating on his own.
That's right. You know, Fred, he started it in Saipan from all the rumors you heard in Saipan from from Marines, and he slowly worked himself backwards. He started in Saipan and ended up working himself backwards. And one of the greatest things about Fred Gorner that a lot of people don't realize is, you know, he was good friends with Admiral Chester Nimitz. Mm. Now, Admiral Chester Nimitz told him on several occasions, you know, Fred, you're on the right track. I believe that the American people need to know what happened to Amelia Earhart. But he couldn't say anything. He was commissioned officer till the day he died, and this was absolute top secret.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have, obviously we have an immense amount of eyewitness testimony. We've talked about it to support the hypothesis, but now you have to go out and find sort of scientific proof or hard evidence, and that's what you did. So you got to kind of corroborate that testimony and kind of build a case, so to speak. I can imagine when you're starting out to do that, it can be kind of quite overwhelming. How did you start when you started doing that, and what were your first steps? How did you kind of lay that out in your mind?
Well, you know, it was really interesting how it all happened, because I was very fortunate in the fact that, you know, I sell these aluminum boat kits. I load containers here at my facility in Bow, Washington, and then I send them all over the world. I build 200 boats a year in Africa, supplying parts and materials to a builder, Ali Boats, in Botswana. And so I'm always loading containers, sending them to different places. Well, there's a man that's in the Marshall Islands, Martin Daly. We use his ship when we filmed the movie. Martin is a very dear friend of mine. He's the world's leading surfing explorer. And so he discovered the Marshall Islands just a couple of years before I did. And we became pretty good friends. I loaded containers for him and sent him lots of material for a resort that he's building on one of the atolls. And so he had ships there. And so I started telling him this whole story. And I had several connections of him, of his, from some different people. And so he said, you know, I'll tell you what, if you help pitch in for fuel, I've got some other people that are going to be going down towards Mille Atoll. Maybe we can organize this. You know, let's go ahead and do this expedition. So I started putting everything together, buying metal detectors, getting everything organized for this expedition. And sure enough, I put together the first expedition. And my first thought on this was, you know, this is kind of crazy. Here I am, school teacher from Mount Vernon, Washington, and I'm gonna mount an attempt at an expedition to go look for Amelia Earhart. It was pretty overwhelming. I gotta tell you, it was really overwhelming at first. And after recording all of those different stories, and then I started talking to an author that wrote a book, The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart, Carol Dow.
Yes.
And I started getting everything together. And sure enough, this first expedition became reality. I flew to the Marshall Islands. I gathered everything we needed. We got on, we took two of Martin's ships. We took his 46-foot Sea Ray. We couldn't do it by itself because we had to have one of his mother ships to keep enough fuel so we could make it there and back, because it's about 80 miles down to Mille from Majuro. And Majuro, of course, is the capital. Yeah. So we took his bigger ship, the Windward, which we filmed the movie on. You can see parts of that. And his Sea Ray, Martin and I and Ramsey, with one of the local Iroges, took the Sea Ray. We came out a day behind of the Windward. And when we got down there, we made it. There was also Sergey Brin's boat, Dragonfly, was also following us and watching us because they wanted to see what's going on.
You guys had a whole fleet with you.
And we did. And it was kind of an adventure. So we spent quite a bit of time, 3 days, just scouring the island. And I had, by the time it was all said and done, I had 7 metal detectors, and with each one of those metal detectors, we had 2 natives with shovels to dig and do and find anything we could find. And as we did that, we started finding a few metal fragments on the very first expedition. We found what looked like APU covers with orange paint on them, aluminum. Now, it's important to note that on this island, there we have no recorded airplane crashes from World War II within several miles of this region of Mille Atoll. This is quite a ways away. This is on the north side of Mille. The only plane crashes in the lagoon were several miles away from World War II. So any aluminum, you know, when aluminum doesn't float, these pieces couldn't have floated up on there. After several bits of testing, which we can talk about later, that came from the Parker expedition that actually right. funded one of my trips.
Sure. Yeah.
That ended up being, you know, pretty interesting because we took a magnetometer on that trip and made things a little bit more in depth. But just to get back to how I got started on it was, it was kind of one of these things was the stars all aligned, should I say, for me to just go ahead and make this trip.
Sure.
This whole story has come to me very easy. And you probably saw that on one of the interviews that I did on TV. There was this, something eerie has happened on this whole thing because I didn't go out looking for Amelia Earhart. And I didn't go out looking for this story. This story found me.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's an eerie quote. So, I mean, you've done the work, you've found a lot of physical artifacts. Let's get into it. Can you take us through some of those artifacts that you found, and explain how you feel that, you know, those help kind of, you know, build that case, and support the hypothesis you're working?
Yeah. Well, on that first expedition, right, we found the APU covers,
right.
Which, you know, whether they are or whether they are not, we have no proof. We know that any photographs we have, we see her APU plugs, but they don't have covers on them. Yet there's other Lockheeds of her vintage that do have them on. We've got one piece that was absolutely the most close piece to relevance of being on her aircraft. Actually, there's two parts that became our focal point. One of them being that trim piece. And that trim piece matches identically size and everything as to what would have been on the cowling of her landing gear, where her landing gear comes up inside. It doesn't retract 100% up into the wing, but it retracts into a little bit of a cowling. And that cowling, as the edges of aluminum are reinforced on airplanes to keep from vibration and to stiffen up the edges, they wrap wire around, they wrap the aluminum around a piece of wire to stiffen the edge.
Gotcha.
And we've got that entire edge. It was about, when we first got it before the testing, was about 15 inches long. And
this is the piece that's in the film, right? The documentary?
Yeah, that's right. And another piece that we're going to be doing in the next movie, with information that they didn't really go on and talk about, was a dust cover that is an incredible match to the tailwheel dust cover. Now, it's a remarkable resemblance. There's a Lockheed L-10 in the New England Air Museum, and our dust cover is a perfect match for what's on the back of that. Now, one thing we did do was we did a lot of aluminum testing. Now, these parts still have serial numbers on them. Okay,
right.
Lockheed was good about putting serial numbers on everything, all of their frame and struts, framing and struts, and all the parts. They were really good about it. But, you know, certain parts, especially when you just have pieces of them that were fabricated in the shop as the plane was going out, and we know the series of aluminum were consistent with the aluminum that would have been on her aircraft. Yet we don't have any serial numbers. These are just parts that are consistent with what would have been on her aircraft.
Yeah.
You take that into consideration with the location that the Reverend Lodge one put exactly there. You take a look at the dunnage that was left on that island to help move the airplane. You take into consideration the stories of all the Marshallese that put her there. These are just remarkable, remarkable instances. You just can't deny this.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. What does that do for you? I mean, we'll walk back towards this. I mean, you came into this thing thinking initially that you just crashed and sank. You started hearing stories from the Marshallese, stories upon stories upon stories that just start to kind of like add up for you. You go out there and, you know, you decide to mount this expedition. You start finding physical artifacts that are kind of, you know, shifting into the case for you to kind of build this case. Are you feeling sense of vindication that you're finding these things and starting to add up and you're starting to build this case and starting to kind of come together for you?
Yes. And let me tell you something to go with that. And that is that the people that really do their research about Amelia Earhart and this whole story, they end up going along this storyline and they take the Japanese capture theory seriously when they do their research, because there's so much more evidence to this story than anything else. And anybody that goes on any different direction, they're in it for the money. And now let's talk about money. While I just mentioned that, okay, sure. Just, you know, that I'm not in this for the money. Okay. I put $60,000 at this point, and you probably heard me quote before this last summer and before this last expedition, Mike, I put $50,000 of my own money into this. Okay. I haven't made a dime on this thing. I was paid enough in the movie, this last movie, which was a very insignificant amount, to cover the last expedition that I did with them. That's all I've made from them, okay? So deduct that out of the $60,000, and you still have me in the neighborhood of about $50,000 that I'm in it, my own money, okay? This story came to me. I didn't go after it, and I've been out trying to do what I can do, and I'm researching this, looking at, I've looked at all the different stories, all the different theories.
Right.
And this story has so much more credible evidence than anything else does. And you look at it from a scientific point of view. It's not gossip. It's not anything else. This is a scientific point of view. When you start looking at post-loss radio transmissions, when you start looking at the parts and pieces we found, and you start looking at photographs, and you start talking looking and reading information from people like Thomas Devine, Don Cothera, the material that Mike Campbell has brought up, and which has been basically research of some of these greats like Thomas Devine,
right.
Fred Warner, and these people that were the firsthand people that were involved in this story when all those firsthand people were alive and that information was there. So many people were so close to discovering this. Loomis, on the Loomis expedition, when he was in the Marshall Islands, he was so close to solving it. And if he would have, been just a little bit... faster and a little bit ahead of what he was doing, he probably could have solved it. So, you know, here we are putting together everything from all these people. I was very fortunate because I brought a lot of these people together. When I first made my, when I went public with what I had everybody in the Amelia Earhart world calling me, okay? Everybody that was doing anything about it. I'm getting phone calls. Mike Harris, he was one of the first people called. Mike Harris and Rich Martini.
Yep.
They, right off the bat, they talked to me when I went public. They got on an airplane. They flew up here to see me. They stayed with me at my house for the weekend. Rich and I played guitar together, and we talked, and we had a great time. In fact, it was Mike was the one that put together he was the one that made the contact to the Parker expedition, which was the expedition I led.
Yes.
Mike was the one that put that together and got us together with John Jeffrey and the whole Parker boys. And that was a great expedition. That one was very serious, very hardcore scientific expedition.
Yeah. Big shout out to Mike Harris, Rich Martini, Mike Campbell. Obviously John Jeffrey, we just talked to John a couple of weeks ago. We'll be having him up coming up pretty soon in the podcast. All those folks are great.
All good people, good people. And you know, they're people that have got a good reputation.
Yeah. Agreed. Okay. So let's get into one of the fun parts we're going to talk about. We're going to shift gears a bit and we're going to talk about something that has simply become known as the photo that you referred to a little bit earlier. We'll backtrack a little bit here. Let's talk about the origin a bit of the photo. Les finds this photo in the National Archives. How did you first learn? I know you're really close with Les, but how did you first learn of the photo in question? And what was your initial thought process when you first saw it?
Okay. Well, you know, as I mentioned, everybody in the Amelia Earhart world was getting a hold of me. I interviewed them all. And there was one person who really, to me, came out stronger than the others. And that's simply in the way Les researches. Okay.
Right.
And so I started doing a lot of things with Les. Now, Les and I, you know, we shared a lot of information. I looked at the volumes of information Les has got. He's got more information on Amelia Earhart than anybody. He's been doing it for 30 years, yeah. Full time for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, Les, he's in Florida. He gives me a call, and he's spent months and months in the National Archives, and he photographs everything,
yeah.
And catalogs it. And he, when he first took the photograph of this picture, he didn't realize what he'd actually had. And so as he took that picture and then later he goes back and he goes through them and researches them. And this was probably 2 years after he'd taken the photograph. He was looking at it and started studying it and seeing what it was he had. He gets on the phone and he calls me and he says, Dick, yeah, you got to see this. You got to see this. You got to see this photograph. He drives from Florida back to his house in Olympia, drives all the way across the country. I meet him in Seattle, and we look at this photograph and there it is. I mean, you put everything in the Marshall Island landing theory together. You know, you've got the story of Biliman Amram being in Jalut, treating Fred Noonan. You've got my friend Charlie Dominic, whose uncle, his uncle Tamaki Miyazoya, was a bunker on the Koshu Maru. You have the logs of the Koshu Maru showing that the Koshu Maru is in Jalut the second week in July. I mean, everything just kind of comes together. Now in this photograph, you've got a tall white man who now we have above a 99% accuracy from the FBI saying this is Fred Noonan. You have a white woman with pants on, short hair, in the same photograph. You've got a barge with an airplane that's approximately the same size as Amelia's airplane on it. And to explain a little bit about that barge, the Marshallese tell this story that there was 39 Marshallese men that were conscripted by the Japanese to move that airplane from one side of the island to the other side of the island. Now, you can go on Google Earth and you can look at the satellite shots and you can still see where the coral has been moved aside to make an area where they can get this barge in. And they thought it was pretty ingenious because the Marshallese sunk one end of that barge.
Yeah.
So they could get the plane onto it. And within 100 yards of diving that area, I found a railroad tie that was thrown into the water that came off of the barge for some reason or other. You have those bomb cart parts of those bomb carts you see only in military zones of the Marshall Islands because they had them all over for moving bombs and
right.
such. And those are left on the island, and there's no other reason in the world for those things to be there. Okay, so now this photograph shows the barge with an airplane on it, the Koshu Maru. It's in Jalut. We know it's in Jalut. And you have all these different things that point to this photograph. And we stand 100% behind this photograph still.
Yeah, no, it's very compelling. I think it's, for all intents and purposes, this photo is a bombshell. You know, if it turns out to be 100% verifiable, I know it's the, you know, you guys are working on that now to further verify it and, you know, get some more information out there. This would be the smoking gun that everybody's kind of been talking about. You got, for the first time ever, as you mentioned, you have Amelia, you have Fred, and you have the Flying Laboratory, which is the Lockheed 10 Electra E, in the same image. This is the oldest hypothesis out there since the 1960s, as we talk about. What does that photo do? What does this photo do specifically for this hypothesis and all these years that all this work has been done? I mean, this has got to be, it's got to be huge for you guys to really look at this and be like, look at this is a physical, verifiable, tangible piece of evidence now, in addition to everything else that we have.
Well, you're going to have people that aren't going to believe it. You know, some people that are vested in, financially in other theories that are going to try and throw mud at this story. And, you know, you just can't do it when you take a look at this and you have an objective, open mind, and you see what it is we've got. You know, there's just no way that you can deny it. You know, as far as that Japanese blogger that came up with this scrapbook with loose photos in it, and one of the loose pages happened to have a date that predated her flight. And, you know, we've been to the Diet Library and looked at, as you know, everything that we can to try and see what we've got of a substantial date. And this is a story like we talked about a little bit earlier. You know, some people they just can't believe that the Japanese would take a million. Why is it still a secret now after 80 years? Why, you know, why? Yeah. Okay, so, well, just to go on top on that a little, let me build a little bit more. You know, Les has filed at this point now over 200 Freedom of Information Act requests that have gone on unanswered with the United States government. Mm-hmm. Why? Why have those 200 plus Freedom of Information Act requests not been answered to? And, you know, you have to look at what it takes to do an FOIA. And that is, you know, you have to ask specific questions. You can't generalize. And Les is very good at doing that. And what happens when you, you know, you just don't get a response, or, oh, we're looking into it, or, okay, he's been doing this full time for 10 years. and there are a lot of people, I'd like to be a fly on the wall when these people that have to review what it is we're asking for see this paperwork and can't say anything about it, and it's denied to be returned to us on certain files, specific files that we're looking for. Wow. And, you know, he touched on some of those files that were in the movie. You could see there's a 170-page report that was done relating to Amelia Earhart. Okay, and yet we can't see any of it.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, let me ask you real quick just about the photo in general. Do you think, has it been determined yet, the origin of the photo? We know it was found on the National Archives. How did it get there? Do you guys know how it got there? Was this an accident that kind of slipped through the cracks that Les kind of stumbled upon, or how did this work out?
You know, there was a man in the Marshall Islands, and just to not give his name out, a lot of people know it. I don't want to mention it because I don't want to have a whole bunch of people going and doing searches and filing Freedom of Information Request Acts on top of what we're doing, just because we don't want to plug things up a little bit. But right. He was known to be a person there who worked for the United States government as a spy. Okay. And he took a lot of photographs. And this photograph, there are so many things that are in this photograph, like we talked about. And one of the ways that he could get photographs out was by using them for Japanese tourism, by saying this is about Japanese tourism, bringing people there. Okay, well, and you know, that's where this Japanese blogger found that photograph, was in a Japanese tourism book. And, you know, when they do that, they want to try and put the earliest date that they can put on a copyright to protect themselves.
All right, so we won't go into everything surrounding the photo since it dropped. I know you touched on a little bit of it, so you kind of synopsized a little bit of it for us. But what I do want to do is I want to get your personal thoughts on everything that's happened since the release of the photo and the documentary. What is this ride been like for you now that you guys have the documentary out now, and then everything that's kind of happened since leading up to the documentary, and then, you know, after the documentary, because you and I have talked on the phone, you know, for 3 or 4 months before the documentary and the photo dropped and all that. Kind of where
that's right,
what you guys are going to be doing and talking about and everything. So what has this whole thing been like for you, recording this film, putting yourself out there, and kind of getting this exposure for not only for Hypothesis but for yourself?
Well, you know, I'm kind of the one that held everybody together to do this movie, because we had a lot of different options to do on this movie. We've had a few different film companies look at us, a few different networks look at us. And I kind of held it together for the History Channel and Morningstar Entertainment. They did a very, they did an outstanding job.
Yeah.
And now we are, I mean, it's been a heck of a ride. And, you know, we're really beginning to tell the story. You know, it's going to be, we're not done by any means. We're going to be looking at least another 2-hour show coming up. I'm not going to give you any details on that yet, because you'll see details. We had easily enough film taken and a lot more information to do 4 hours.
Yeah.
We're ongoing research on the photograph, which right. is all positive at this point. It has been a great ride, and you know, I don't know if we're going to finally be able to present enough information to the government to say, okay, release the files. We know you're holding, but we're going to make enough people realize that there's so much evidence in the Japanese capture theory that somebody's going to have to do something.
Yeah. Is that your goal, Dick? I think in this whole thing is, do you want to sort of, I guess how would you feel? I probably know the answer to this already, but how would you feel if you guys were able to kind of present a strong enough case to the U.S. government? Well, to the public, really, that would kind of push the U.S. government to release right. everything they have. What would that do for you? I mean, how would you feel personally? I mean, vindication would be an understatement.
Well, yeah, and I don't. You know, this has never been about the money. Okay. Mm-hmm. This has been about something that, you know, as a school teacher, all of my students have been following this story and I talk about it a lot in the classroom. It's going to change the history books. So that's going to be the reward that I get. But I also told myself going into this that there has to be an end date to this for me, because if you go back and you look at what Amelia Earhart, she destroyed a lot of men's lives, okay, after she was gone. I mean, Fred Gorner, Thomas Devine, all these people, Dan Kothera. I could go on and on about the men who became taken by this story and got so close for so many years but weren't able to get there. I'm not going to let that happen to myself. I'm a very happy, open-minded person about this whole thing. Yeah. And I'm not going to let her destroy my life. So I'm going to put an end date on this. And when I first started out, I said, oh, hey, listen, I'm going to do this. I'll get involved in this for just a couple of years. And, yeah. you know, I've been in it now for 5 years, but we've made more progress probably than anybody else has made. But then again, you know, we've got, you know, with Les Kenny, his information,
right.
Some of the other people that are along this with Mike Harris, Rich Martini, and Mike Campbell always being able to write what he's writing about it from what he got from Thomas Devine and some of the things that Mike has done. There are a lot of good people along this line who are kind of patting us on the back and helping us out wherever they can, saying, you know, we know you guys are right. Do what you can do. We've been able to do it without a whole lot of financial backing. I mean, sure, it would be nice to have somebody back us that would help us do what we need to do, because we're on a shoestring budget. We don't have the money that some of the other researchers have been able to do by telling this miraculous story about, you know, by creating something. We're just telling what's already there.
Yeah. It's interesting. You touched on it, and I want to ask you about it. It's a fun question, but you know, you talked about your students and being a high school science teacher and kind of them being interested in it. We just interviewed a really fascinating young woman named Ellie Norman, who is a high school student, junior in high school, and she's just fascinated with Amelia's life and the disappearance and everything. Amelia continues to speak to kids. I mean, even now, 80 years after she disappeared. Let's talk about your high school students. I mean, you mentioned that they ask you questions about it. What's that like for you? I mean, you got a lot of young minds there that you're kind of working with that are really could potentially take up the search, write books on her, keep her memory and her spirit alive. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you could do with that. How's that been for you?
It's been really great. Let me tell you what happened yesterday. Yesterday, I spent over an hour on the phone with two young girls from junior high named Kate and Meg in St. Louis who, with their teacher, they contacted me and they wanted to do some research on this, and they wanted to interview me and talk to me for quite a while about it. And that was really great. I take a lot of time to do that with the youth. And that's why I teach. God knows I can hardly afford to do it because I've got to keep my business going.
Yeah.
But teaching is something that's always been very, very important to me. I teach computer aided design, which basically is pure geometry, and some other vocational arts. My life being an engineer has always been about science. I'm kind of putting everything together with this whole Amelia Earhart project, and it's going along. I'm able to fit it in between my boat building business, my marine fabrication, everything that I do in my boat kits, and my school teaching. So it's very fulfilling right now. However, we'll see what happens with the financial end of it.
Yeah, I'm with you right there. I'm right there with you. So you touched on it a little bit earlier, and I know you can't go into detail, and that's totally right. I totally respect that. But you did mention that, you know, in our conversations on the phone that, you know, you guys had more than enough to do a 4-hour documentary instead of a 2-hour, and that kind of got hung up with history and all that. So I know there's obviously a lot more. Can you talk about what didn't maybe make the documentary, the original film, and what you guys really wanted? Was there something you really wanted personally putting there that they had to cut or they couldn't put in?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we had some good scenes. There was a great diving scene that we did, and it didn't make the cut. There were several good scenes that didn't make the cut, like any movie. Some of the diving scene... Dan Hampton was a great guy to have in that.
Dan's awesome.
Dan was just a fantastic guy. He's a little shorter than me, but he has the stature of a giant. I love him to death.
Yeah.
And Sean Henry. Mm-hmm. Sean Henry, just a great guy. He doesn't say anything unless he just really knows and thinks about it first, and then he says what he needs to say, and his words always come out intelligent, strong, and he is just a great man.
Yeah, he is.
I really enjoyed working with Sean and Dan when we made this movie, and it was just great to be able to be a part of that. Now, as far as some of the stuff that didn't make it, yeah, we had some good stuff like they have in any television production. The certain different scenes, and we had to cut it down into 86 minutes for a 2-hour show.
Yeah.
It was tough to do that. So there were some scenes, and there's a lot of good, solid information that we have on the rest of the work that I did. There was a lot of emphasis that was put on that photograph. Not probably looking back at it now, not enough emphasis put on the work that I've done, which, I mean, I don't want to brag or anything. I mean, we have to look at all of this as a whole, everything, not just the photograph, but all the different parts and pieces, the rest of the information that Les Kinney has got, documents. There's just so much information that has to be done. And so I'm doing a lot of speaking around the country, different shows and things, and talking about this. That's a question that always comes up. How about, what are you going to do with the show? I mean, what's going to be the next step? And there is going to be another show. I can't tell you when, how long, or what, or anything about it. All I can tell you is there is going to be more information coming out, it's going to further what we've done with the first movie. And the first movie was a big hit. You know, it was one of the number one shows on cable television in the United States in 2017. We had almost 5 million viewers.
Yeah.
So when we come out with what we've got, we're going to have the same thing again.
Fair enough. If there's anything that's completely apparent, it's that the entire world is still very fascinated with and invested in Amelia Earhart. I think your project, Lost Evidence, proved that beyond a shadow of a doubt. As you and I obviously both know, this is the 80th anniversary of Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan's disappearance. What is it about this case specifically that continues to capture the attention essentially of the entire planet 80 years after they disappeared? What's your personal thoughts on that?
Well, you know, Amelia Earhart, she was the woman that started the women's movement. She was a true hero. When she crossed the Atlantic, there was ticker tape parades in New York City for her. A real hero. She was best friends with the First Lady. She was going to teach the First Lady how to fly when she got back from this around-the-world flight. if FDR would have let her. And right. I mean, she was something that all the girls looked up to, you know, and that has a little bit of a touch to me. You know, I teach engineering classes at school, and I'm always trying to get more women involved in engineering arts. I mean, my classes typically have 32 kids in them, and typically I'm only running 2 to 4 girls in those classes. She got women involved in flying. She got women involved. And, you know, that's one of the great things about Amelia Earhart. You know, she might not have been a great pilot, okay? You know, a lot of people will claim, oh, she was a fantastic pilot. Well, you talk to Paul Mance and some of the other people that flew with her. And, you know, she ground looped a plane. And she crashed 11 airplanes, okay? She walked away from every one of them.
Yeah,
that's something to talk to brag about, okay? She was a great woman. She might not have been the greatest pilot, but that doesn't make any difference because what she gained in guts was amazing. I mean, she had more guts than any man out there at the time. She was a great woman. And that's what I love about her, and I love about her story. So she's, you know, she's an icon. And that's why everybody today, still, they're enamored with this story. You know, what happened to her? What happened to her? And the biggest question I always get asked is, well, you know, why after 80 years? Come on, let's let this story out. Let's, you know, bring it out. Let's talk about it. You know, the government can't be hiding anything anymore. Come on, why not? Well, you have to look back in 1937. You know, FDR did everything he could do to bury this. And the reason is quite simple. You know, in 1937, 75% of the population were isolationists. They were trying to keep us out of the conflict that was going on in Europe and in Asia. We've got Japan going eastward across the Pacific. You got Hitler doing everything he's doing in Europe. And here we are in the United States of America. We've got 75% of the population that knows, you know, still World War One is still very vivid, and they don't want to get involved in another conflict in the world. They just didn't want to do it. And FDR is protecting that 75%. Well, here comes Amelia Earhart flying around the world, right, trying to set this goal. A lot of people say, oh, she was a spy. She was a spy. Well, I don't believe she was a spy. She happened to be good friends with FDR, and FDR probably said, well, listen, if you see something, could you maybe take some pictures for us? And I could see that being as far as her spying mission goes, right?
Right.
Okay, so she flies across, gets captured, you know, and through a series of you know, poor navigation, bad luck, ends up not being able to find Howland Island, which would be like flying from Los Angeles to New York, trying to find the 18th hole on a golf course in New York without a single navigational aid all the entire way.
Yeah.
She ends up missing Howland Island to the north, turns around, flies back, ends up in Millie, and she ends up eventually, you know, a lot of people in that photograph say, well, why wasn't she in cuffs? Well, at that point, she's in Japanese custody. She probably thinks that, you know, I'm still on my way home.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Japanese, they're probably trying to figure out what to do with her at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, what I always tell everybody is that 1937, FDR made a tough call to keep it quiet because of this conflict that was going on. If the American public would have known that Amelia Earhart was being held by the Japanese, that could have put us into a conflict with the Japanese 4 years before Pearl Harbor. And at that time, the Japanese Navy was a lot larger than our Navy in the Pacific. Okay, so if we would have got into a conflict back then, who knows? Chris, you and I might be speaking Japanese today. Also, something else to talk about was that in 1940, FDR had a big election coming up.
Yeah.
Against Wendell Willkie. And with Wendell Willkie, you know, just think what would have happened to history if he would, he was supporting that 25% that wanted to get involved. So you look at the historical ramifications of what could have potentially gone down. Now, I'm not saying FDR made the wrong call. Okay, I'm saying FDR probably made a, he was a smart man, and he probably made a very calculated call to keep Amelia Earhart silent. Well, at this point now, 37, 38, 39, 40, he's probably doing everything he can do to bury this information just so it doesn't get out that he knew.
Yeah. What does that do to his legacy, do you think? I mean, if let's say tomorrow, the, you know, the United States government releases all the information, we find out as a country that, you know, FDR did in fact know, as you just stated, and he was, did everything he could to kind of bury it. What does that do to FDR's legacy all these years later?
Oh, well, you know, when you ask a lot of Democratic presidents that have been presidents lately, you know, Obama, he referred to his idealistic president as FDR. Bill Clinton said the same thing. And, you know, they idolize, FDR has been idolized by a lot of our most recent Democratic presidents.
Right.
And you know, it's going to give him a black eye. There's no doubt it's going to give him a black eye. But what I tell everybody is that, you know, he made a tough call at the time. And it might have been the right call.
Yeah.
To keep it silent, to keep us out of war at that time. Hmm. It's going to tarnish his, it's going to give FDR a black eye.
So, okay. So, where can folks follow your work online? Is there a specific website they can go to? I know you plugged your business website earlier. Feel free to plug whatever you like to plug.
I've been working on a website, and we took it completely down to completely rebuild it. And we're in the process now of rebuilding it.
Okay.
And that website, that's going to be AmeliaEarhartResearch.org.
Okay.
We're going to put a lot of this up. And you'll see a lot of it. So that's where it's at for now.
Okay.
And like I say, it's not up right now because we've got so much information. So much is happening right now with what it is we're doing. But be looking for some big things to happen here in the near future.
Great. Yeah, maybe we can have you back on when you launch the website so we can kind of talk about what all the content on the website. I think people would like to hear that. Any last thoughts you'd like to share about Earhart, your personal work, anything else before we wrap this up?
I just wanted to say thanks to you and the people that are involved in this. I know you're trying to get several different theories out there to try and listen to a little bit of everything. You've got to do that. And we are trying to do this in a very systematic, thorough, logical way, with all the science that we currently have available to us. And, we're taking it all very seriously. And all we're trying to do is set the history book straight.
Dick, it's been an absolute honor. Thank you so much. I know you got a lot going on. You're really busy. So thank you for taking the time to sit in on the Chasing Earhart podcast with us.
I really appreciate you having me on, and I'll keep you posted, and maybe we'll be back on again sometime.
So I really hope you enjoyed that episode with Dick. Like I said, it was a long time coming. We're really hoping to have him back again when his website launches so we can talk about the content that's going to be on the website. He will also be doing a little bit more with us for the project in the coming months as far as shooting the documentary and as far as doing a really special event that we're working on for the Amelia Earhart Festival next summer in Atchison, Kansas. So we're very excited to have Dick aboard the project. He's a great wealth of knowledge, and he's a very fun interview. So want to thank Dick for his time, and we're very excited to have him back again on the podcast. Now, as we always do, I like to preview next week's guest, and this is someone that I just recently learned about not too long ago, and I'm very excited to have her. You might not know who she is, but I can promise you after next week's interview, a lot of people will be talking about her because she's the very definition of what Chasing Earhart is all about. This young girl's name is Ellie Norman, and she's currently in high school, and she's been studying Amelia Earhart's life for quite some time, and she's doing this from a high school student perspective, and this is really sort of the audience that we're trying to kind of attract for the Chasing Earhart project. She is a fantastic interview. She speaks very eloquently about what Amelia Earhart means to her, why Amelia is so important. And we really get into, you know, her experience and her inspiration when it comes to Amelia Earhart and what she means to her and what she means to a lot of young girls that are out there right now that are kind of looking for a role model, looking for someone to sort of look up to. And she really puts it into great perspective, and it's a very great interview, and we're very excited to have her. I was floored by her story, and I'm going to let her tell you her story and kind of how that ties into the disappearance search. But we're very excited to have her on next week, and she will be next week's guest, and we're very excited to bring her to you and bring her story to you. So we will see you in 7 days with Ellie Norman. This has been episode 14 of Chasing Earhart Podcast. My name is Chris Williamson. Thanks for joining us.